So for today, we are going to be discussing a midrash in that comes up in Parashat Miketz. But this is going to be a midrash that's not quite one which you're used to seeing. So before I get to what the exact midrash is, I have a question for everybody. What is a kal vachomer? Or if your Latin's a little bit better than your Hebrew, an a fortiori argument, argumentum fortiori. So if that makes sense, if somebody had to say a couple words, you had to try and say what a kal vachomer was. If you don't know what it is, don't worry, I'm going to explain it. But in your head, when you hear the word kal vachomer, what do you think of? Either what it means or when you hear it.
Well, if this is true, then of course something else is true.
Right. If this, then of course that also. Right? We actually say the phrase kal vachomer every day during davening, right? When we say Rabbi Shmuel Omer. So we actually have, right? So one of the 13 methods of learning things out from the Torah is using a kal vachomer. So I thought it might be worthwhile to look. So also because the Midrash happens to quote kal vachomer. So we're going to be looking into what exactly kal vachomer is a little bit. And then we'll, but of course, the best example, way to understand what a kal vachomer is, and I see examples. So we'll see some of the examples as it comes up in the psukim. Okay? So yes. So I'm going to give two definitions. One of them is from Wikipedia. One of them is from the Ars Scroll Sitter. So one of them looks way more technical and fancy. One of them makes a lot more sense. Okay? So we'll start with the fancy one from Wikipedia. Okay? Just because, Okay, so argumentum a fortiori, literally an argument from the stronger. It's a form of argumentation that draws upon existing confidence and proposition to argue in favor of a second proposition that is held to be implicit in and even more certain than the first. Yeah, so that doesn't really help us much, right? You read it, you're like, I have no idea what they said. So to that, we have Ars Scroll translated it for the common man, did a very good job. So let's focus on the first line over here, right? So it's a conclusion inferred from Conclusion inferred from a lenient law to a strict one and vice versa, right? You see one thing, you see something else, you think they compare, and then that's what we got. Right, so logic dictates that if a lenient case has a stringency, then the stringency applies to the stricter case. Right, thus laws can be derived from less obvious situations to more obvious ones. Okay, right, so that we can, right, so basically it's a logical inference from point A, point B, they're similar, right, so therefore we can apply something based on those two different cases. So this makes a lot of sense in terms of when we're dealing with laws. Right, various Jewish laws, it makes perfect sense. But how does this end up working into the Midrash? Right, you normally would think that they're two separate things, right? Laws and Midrash, no connection. But actually, even when we're talking about Midrash Agadah, right, the Midrash that normally is telling over a story, it still also can help inform us about some of the other parts of Torah as well. So here we go. So we're now going to jump into the Midrash. If somebody wants to see it inside, you're welcome to open up the Midrash Rabbah to 927. But I have brought it all in front of us, which will hopefully it'll be clear. Again, if anybody has any questions at any point, please feel free to chime in. If your screens are on, I'll see you waving. If not, then please unmute and ask your questions. Goal is to make it as understandable as possible. And for that, I need to know what you're saying, because I can try and infer what you understand or don't understand, but it's not quite as good as getting it directly from the source. So here we go. So I mentioned earlier how the people are probably most familiar with the term kal vachomer from when we say it during davening from Rabbi Shmuel Omer, right? You say it right before the first Kaddish of davening, Rabbi Shmuel Omer, right? So the 13 hermeneutical principles. So believe the word, whether a hermeneutical means aside, it means ways to understand the text. So, and now here we have a Midrash quoted by that very same Rabbi Yishmael. So Yishmael, again, who used his principles for expounding laws, also sees this being very useful in terms of understanding of the way arguments work in Tanakh as well, right? Throughout various parts of scripture, there are arguments given utilizing the same logic that was later used for laws, they're utilized now. So who would like to give it a shot for the first a fortiori argument or kal vachomer argument in the Torah? It is from this coming week's Parsha Mikates. So who thinks that they can make a good defense and a good argument? Please feel free. We're going to be reading the English just to make things easier, because, and I'll point out whenever there's, you know, a cool pun or something in the Hebrew.
Okay.
All right.
Indeed, we return the silver. Obviously, we wouldn't steal.
Okay, so, right, so when you see just this line being quoted by the Midrash, it's not necessarily makes sense right away, because unless you have a really good grasp of this coming week's Parsha, which some people might, but many people don't. So for that, we're going to go to the next slide and hopefully explain that, right? So the extra word, if you look in the Hebrew, you'll notice that in the middle of the line of the pasuk, they added the words kal vachomer in the Midrash itself. Okay, the translation, it kind of got subsumed into the translation of Eich, as we'll see in a second, right? So we go to the pasuk itself. So this is the brothers. Okay, so let me fast forward, you know, this is towards the end of this week's Parsha. So we had the brothers came down to visit Egypt. When Yosef is in charge of all of Egypt, they're trying to get food. So the first time they manage to get food, right? Yosef and Yosef recognizes them. They don't recognize Yosef. And then Yosef starts an elaborate plan of trying to get the brothers to repent and make amends for what they've done. So part of this is he puts them to trying situations and seeing if they'll crack or not. So one of the things he does is the first time around, he made sure to give everybody back the money from what they had initially, right? They came down with a lot of money to buy grain, and then they bought the grain and are heading back. And Yosef told his officers to make sure to put all the money they paid back at the bottom. And this way they could test if they're really honest or not. And that way the next time they came, when the brothers came, you know, after they finished all the food, they then brought the extra money. They're like, yeah, so we don't know how this money got here, but like, here's the money. We somehow got extra money. Like, I don't know, it's a mistake. We got some money back that we shouldn't have gotten earlier. So here's that money back. And also here's even more money for the next round of grain you want to buy. So they were trying. So basically Yosef's brothers were showing how honest they were and how much integrity they had. But the test of Yosef wasn't done yet. Now Yosef also tests them again by, as they leave the second time, he not only does he put money in their sacks, he also puts in his prized goblet. So now as they are running away, as they're heading on home, then he intentionally sends them to chase after them and say, hey, do you happen to have my goblet? And what's the response? But this is their indignant response after being asked, so did you steal it or not? So who'd like, Abba, could you read again the full response of the brothers?
Here we brought back to you from the land of Canaan, the money that we found in the mouths of our bags. How then could we have stolen any silver or gold from your master's house? We returned it all.
Right. So this is we're saying in terms of, you know, a kal vachomer argument, if this, then that, it's like, why would we go through all that effort of bringing all that money all the way back if we're just going to steal from you again, right? Why would we bother, right? If we were honest then, of course we're going to be honest now. Like, why would we bother bringing back money where nobody would know about, only to steal? That just seems like, right? So this is their argument. We say it's pretty convincing. It sounds like they made a good argument. This, then that, it seems to logically flow. Correct?
But the situation was, no matter what they said, it would have been wrong. So
Right. Correct. That situation, right? The end doesn't work out, but the point being is that there, the words they say logically flow from point A to point B, right? A, then B, then C, right? It makes sense. Okay, so some would argue that actually, I believe these phaetoar, which is a commentary, a commentary on Midrash, says actually there's another 12 besides these 10, and says that actually these 10 are the least obvious kalachomers, but I think this is, but from what I see, at least these seem to maybe fairly straightforward and obvious, and right. So okay, we're not going to get the other 12, which is these 10, right? So again, if somebody had a reason why I thought this wasn't obvious, that'd be great. But I think you could say that this is pretty clear. Good argument by the brothers. Unfortunately, they were set up and were doomed to lose no matter what happened. Okay. So you don't get, no matter how good your lawyer is, no matter how good your defense, if you're framed, well, you're framed. Okay. So now we have another. So that's case number one. So again, so there are going to be 10 total. Again, if we run out of time, we'll simply pause and know the list. But hopefully, we'll see how many examples we can get through. We'll try and give everybody a chance to read through at least one. That way, we'll be able to get a chance to, you know, get a better grasp both on the Midrash as well as on what it means to be a Kalvachom. Because again, I can explain it to you the logical points from here till tomorrow, but you'll eyes will glaze over. But if you remember a good example, that'll hopefully stick with you. Okay, so the next case we have is with Moshe. Okay, so we've now finished Sefer Bereishit. We are now in the beginning of Sefer Shmot. We have Moshe currently in the land of Midian, and God is trying to convince Moshe to become the leader and go before the Jews and Paro, and convince both of them that it is time for the Jews to leave. So now this is Moshe protesting against God. Okay? So he's very worried and he doesn't know how it's all going to work out. So we're going to read, so first we'll read, you know, what the Midrash quoted, and then we'll read the, again, everybody can see my mouse? Yes? Okay? Okay, so we're going to start over here on the right is the original Midrash. Again, I'll point out that, again, that in the middle of the Pasuk, in the middle of, right, so in the Midrash inserts the words, the Kal Vachomer. Meanwhile, in the Pasuk itself, it has the word Ve'ech, right? Or, right, so in English, it ends up getting kind of, right, ends up getting swallowed together, right? That the Kal Vachomer and the word Ech, when you translate it, right, this, even more so than that, which translates basically to obviously or certainly, right, which kind of condenses. So basically, as opposed to normally, it's but in the Midrash, they're expanding the translation of saying that the eich isn't just and how. It's saying there's a logical argument behind the saying that how could I? It's giving a added step there to make it, the argument make more sense and stronger. Okay, so who would like to read Moshe's argument to God? Let's see, Morty. I know your name isn't Moshe, but your name is close. So would you be able to read it for us in English?
But Moshe appealed to the Lord, saying, "The Israelites would not listen to me. How then should Pharaoh heed me, a man of impeded speech?"
Very good. Right. So who is the more likely to listen? Meaning, we start from the easier and then go to the harder. So who's the one who you would have hoped would listen, but Moshe is sure even they won't?
The Israelites.
Right, the Israelites. And then Moshe's convinced there's no way the Jews are going to listen, but the Israelites will not listen. And then God's saying, oh yeah, now go tell Paro and let my people go. He's like, that's not going to go. There's no way. I can't do that. So, of course, we happen to be in the future, so we know the answer to Moshe's doubt. But we know the answer. What's the answer? What happens in the end? Who agrees? The Israelites or Paro? Who agrees?
The Israelites.
Right, the Israelites agree in the end. Unfortunately, Paro does not. So, right? So again, but for that, we'll be hopefully getting more into that as the parsha go along and we get to, we get to Sefer Shmuel. Right? So here we see how Moshe is using the argument of Kal Vachomer too. He's also saying how if the Jews won't, then of course Paro won't. It's interesting to note that just like before, it ended up working out not so positively. Meaning last time what happened? Like last time the brothers made the argument, and even though their argument made sense, they were wrong and they were set up. Meaning they technically were innocent, but they ended up being, set up. Here too. I mean, Moshe's argument makes sense, but he's simply wrong, right? Because the Jews will agree almost immediately as soon as they're told that you're going to be leaving. They're like, yeah. Yeah, not that they won't complain and grumble, but they believe. So, yep. Okay. So, right, so this is, right, this, so this is, again, this is case number two. Okay, so we're going to be, as we keep going forward, we'll see again, we're going to be jumping to other different books of Tanakh. Again, so then I'll frame each time. So that way, again, as some of the circumstances are less, the first couple are from Torah, hopefully what people are a little familiar with, or we're going to soon get the stuff from other places in Tanakh, which are not necessarily as popular as the first couple. Okay. So now we have number three, hopefully also still within people's remembering, little memory. Okay, so now here we have what had just happened prior. So we had Miriam had just gotten Sarat. This is after Miriam and Aaron had been talking about Moshe and his wife. And what exactly that discussion was and behind that is a separate discussion in and of itself. But basically, Miriam has just gone Sarat for talking badly about Moshe. And now we're in a situation where she had Sarat. The question is, how long are we going to wait and why are we going to have to wait for what happens in terms of the of Miriam having Sarat, and we're also going to be seeing this is following Moshe's argument saying, Kel na rafa na la, right? God, please heal her now. Again, the shortest prayer ever, right? Just five words. So now this is God utilizing the tool this time. So who would like to play with the voice of God? Anybody feel that they want to be who's one of most likely who likes Ray Earl Jones? I think he's the one who normally ends up doing the voiceover for God. Who thinks they can they're up to the challenge?
Zeus or Sharps?
Volunteers? Okay, I guess I'll have to give it a go then. All right. Okay. For the Lord said to Moses, if her father spat in her face, would she not bear her shame for 7 days? Let her be shut out of the camp for 7 days, and then let her be readmitted. So here God is giving a reason that if somebody had been, that if her father, again, notice the lowercase father, there, right, had spat in her face, she would be ashamed to not show her face for a whole week. Similarly, so therefore she must be out of the whole encampment for 7 days because she has Sarat, she has leprosy, and then only then she can come back. So the Midrash, right, so again, quite similar, right, the puzzle looks almost the same. Adds the words Kal Vachomer L'Shechina, but interestingly enough, the Midrash says Arba'a Asar Yom. So it actually says it should be 14. So how would you end up getting a 14? Because didn't the pasuk only say seven? So the answer is because when you have tzaraat, what ends up happening is you have to actually be seen by Kohen twice. So it ends up being a total 14-day process, right? First, there's the first 7 days. The first time you show to the Kohen, you have tzaraat. Then he comes back again to see if it grew a week later. And then you would be put outside of the camp for 7 days with tzaraat. And that's why it comes out to 14. In case you're wondering why there was 14, that's confusing. So that's the answer to that. But here we see that God is getting in, is also using the Kal Vachomer, right? So one case, right? So if you want from the Pesukim, it doesn't really quite look like it's a Kal Vachomer, right? If you simply read the text, it's like, so 7 days, 7 days. So that might be exactly the same. But in the Midrash, they say even more so, because they're showing how if it was just your parent who had done so, that would be one thing. But of course, if it is, you know, you're being rebuked by God, right by the Shekhinah, then it would be even more strict. So then it shows clearly how we have the lesser case and the more strict case. Okay, so that is case number three. Hopefully by the end, we'll hopefully all be able to have Kal Vachomer clearly in our mind from at least one of these stories. So at the end, we're going to have a vote over which story we liked best. Okay? So we'll do that at 9:05. Okay? We'll say which one of these arguments we liked best. So just note your favorites. Either you like it because the story is the best or because the argument is the best, your choice. Okay? Next, we have case number four. So now we're back to Moshe. Unfortunately, Moshe, so how many years have passed since the last time we heard Moshe speaking? So before we were in the very beginning of Shemot, and now we're at the very end of Devarim. So there have been 40 years, time have passed, and Moshe, we would have hoped would have had a much more positive outlook. But unfortunately, it's like the Jews have shown him that he was a little bit right earlier when he said he didn't quite he was proven wrong earlier, but he still seems like Moshe a little skeptical about the way that the Jews will react. So who here has been skeptical about what their kids have done before and would like to read what Moshe has to say? Or anybody who's been a teacher before, just been a little bit skeptical. Yeah.
Well, I know how defiant and stiff-necked you are even now. While I am still alive in your midst, you have been defiant toward the Lord. How much more than when I am dead?
Yep. So here, so this is Moshe rebuking them right before he passes away. You were obstinate when I was alive and I was trying to correct you. When I pass away, which Moshe knows he's about to pass away, he's like, even more so, you're going to run into issues. So he's trying to, like, you know, his parting words of advice for B'nai Yisrael. Yeah, it's a little sad. On the other hand, you understand why he would say it. And as far as it being a good Kal Vachomer, it looks pretty solid, right? If you weren't good now, when you have me tell it, though the argument could be said by you know, children could say, not that I would say this, of course, my parents here, but that sometimes it takes the kid to be in a place without the parent to fully realize whether or not they really will be acting the same way as, because sometimes when you're thrust into the, into a position, you might end up, you know, having to improve. But oftentimes, you know, people just simply don't. So I believe this happens in I can only speak to the Israeli army because I only have friends who've done that. So one of my friends who trains, he trained the people who end up becoming the officers. So an often thing that you have, like, you know, during training camps, that people always try and slack off and cut corners, right? So this was happening even at the officers' training camp, right? You know, oh, like you want to like, you know, cut a little bit off when you're trying to do the laps, you know, drag your feet a little bit, you know? And yet when those same officers are, you know, then end up, you know, finish the course and become officers, then they actually are the same ones pointing out to the incoming recruits, don't cut that corner, don't flag off, because so sometimes, ironically, when the parent or when the, you know, the figure, the authority figure isn't there, sometimes it actually, or when they become the authority figure, it actually spurs them to development. But Moshe was both right and wrong, because the Jews definitely did sin quite a bit after his death. But not necessarily during the time of Yeshua. They were pretty solid, but, you know, from more on, the Jews making mistakes, we can look at Sefer Shoftim, where they had a cycle of do something terribly wrong, have to be redeemed by one of the Shoftim, one of the judges, and then, right, and then rinse, repeat, right? Sin, God punishes them, they get rescued by a judge, and it goes on for the entirety of the book. So it's like, yeah, so like, the Jews make mistakes, and that's okay. I mean, yeah, that's just how it is. So, right, so Moshe's not so great expectations. Okay, now that's case number 4. And next we have case number 5. So for all those who have... Right, so this is so... Here, so I'm going to give a little bit of a brief summary of Jeremiah, right? So Jeremiah, or Yirmiyahu, so he was the one of the last prophets during the first temple. He was there before he foretold about his destruction, as well as followed the Jews into exile. So amongst the things that he had been telling the Jews is that you really need to in addition to the general stop sinning against God. He also, which he repeated many times, he also was mentioning how you're better off staying in Israel and being subservient to the Babylonians, and you are fighting back against them because you're going to lose. God wants you to be subservient because you don't deserve to be in charge of yourselves right now. And then there was like, oh, maybe we'll, you know, leave to the other side of the Jordan. We'll, you know, go head off to Egypt. Oh, we'll go head off somewhere else, you know, and then fight back. And Yirmiyahu is saying, that's a really terrible idea. Don't do it. Okay, so this one actually is, there's two Kol Vachomers in this pasuk. So we're going to read from on the right over here. Who here likes to go for jogs or walks? I think they're pretty good at it. Nobody here exercises? That's so sad.
I would also read. Read.
Okay, I bike, I don't run.
It's close.
If you race with the foot runners and they exhaust you, how can you compete with horses?
Okay, pause.
You are secure only.
Wait, pause. Okay, that was the first one, right? So if you can't keep up with the people who run by foot, you expect to be able to beat those who have horses. So it's saying how the Jews think they're all, I guess the most similar case would be if you think that you're so fast that you can't beat the, you know, you're not the fastest person on the block, yet you think you train for the Olympics. It's just like, what are you thinking, right? You can't beat out, you know, the other person over there locally on foot, and you think that you can outrun a horse, right? Humans can't really outrun horses, as I'm sure you've probably seen. Right?
Unless
you're Jesse Owens.
Okay, that was in a very controlled setup, and horses tend to extend their lead as they have a slower. Takes them longer to reach the max. They have slower acceleration, but they definitely have a higher max speed and can maintain it for longer than human beings can. So, yes, could you get a good head start on a horse? Maybe, but then it'll run you flat. And when I say horses here, they're referring to more, you know, like horses and chariots, like coming to kill you in war, than just, you know, a nice boring foot race. So, right, so seemingly, right, so that's the first kalvachoma, right? You think you can run. We all know the Jews are not quite that fast. And so, nope, sorry. Again, no offense to all Jewish Olympic athletes, etc. Just an idiom. Okay. So next we have, so that was number five. And number six is the second half of the verse. So, right, so why? So again, comparing the right different types of races, you know, foot race, you can lose the foot race, of course, you lose against a horse. And now we have a comparison between different types of lands. Okay, so if you are secure only in a tranquil land, how will you fare in the jungle of the Jordan? Okay, so if you are, you know, barely holding on in Israel, which is, you know, a very calm place, as opposed to on the other side of the Jordan, is considered to be a lawless land. In case you're wondering, well, where do we see it being a lawless land? So we see this actually in the book of Judges by the judge Yiftach, who is sent into exile because his family didn't like kind of hated him. So he's sent to go, to go live on the side of the Jordan, and he falls in with some bandits. And then you know, becomes the head bandit, and then comes back and leads the Jewish people. Again, strange story, but point being is that the Jordan is a very rough area. It is not for the faint of heart. It is like it. So as opposed to North America, they speak about the wild, wild west. So in Israel, it's the wild, wild east of the Jordan. So right. So if you can't cut it here in the nice, calm Israel, you think you'll be able to handle it on the other side of the Jordan River? The answer is you'll get eaten alive. I'm sorry, you can't do it. Okay, so that's the Jews are not meant to be, not spend the tent outdoors, right? They are simply meant to remain and live a nice, happy, and quiet life. So there are many, also, there again, not to say anything against all of my friends who are Eagle Scouts and the like. Okay, that was case number six. Okay, we still have four more to go. Hopefully, we'll be able to fit it in. Okay, the next case we have is by Shmuel. Say for Shmuel, this is now David had his band of merry men who were defending and patrolling the desert of Judea, of Yehuda. And so currently they had basically been more or less at war on and off with the armies of Shaul, who had been the king at the time. It is before David became King David, right? He was still just David. But he was, well-respected military leader and military man in his own right. So here, the question is, so the city of Keilah had been seized. And the question is, can he go and free them from it or not? So David is thinking that he should go. But the problem is his men are not quite so certain. Right? He'll have been taken over by the Plishtim. So what do his men say to him? Look, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more if we go to Keilah, get the forces of the Philistines? Right? So they are... Right, so if we're scared now because we don't want to fight against, you know, Shaul, and we're not fighting with them deliberately, then why would we fight against the Plishtim? We're our enemy's enemy. So even more so, we can't beat them. So there's only one, right? So again, sounds like a good argument. But what's the only problem with that argument? Is that who really decides who wins? God decides who wins. And why hasn't David won against Shaul? Because David keeps letting him go. Not because David can't, I believe at this point there's already been two chances for David to assassinate Shaul and deliberately does not. Because he's like, he's the king. I shouldn't just do a violent coup. Like, I know he's, you know, went crazy, but he's still my father-in-law, and like he still is the king. So like, it's not that he. So it's not that Dove is doing this all because he's afraid. He's doing it all because he's trying to not create a place of the war. And for what? And can Dove take the fight to the place? So the answer is yes. In case you're wondering, what does he or does he not? The answer is the next verse. He asks God, "Can I do so?" And God says, "Yes, you can." And then Dove goes and conquers them. Right, so Dove definitely can. Okay. Okay, so next up, number 8. So now we are in Mishlei. So this is about reward and punishment. So, right. So again, so it's a little works a little bit better in the Hebrew than in English, but we'll go with English, right? So if the righteous on earth get their deserts, how much more the wicked than man and the sinner? Okay, this is the translation from Sfaria. So again, so I'll do a little.
Desserts is spelled with two S's. Is it deserts or desserts?
It's desserts. I copied it from JPS. I don't know. This is what they had on Safari from JPS 1985. So I guess that's happened in the original too. Okay, right. So basically, if you're the righteous, right, we see that they get, if they did something wrong, they get paid back for it on this earth. So even more so, the wicked and the sinners will definitely be paid back by God eventually also. Right? We see that people who are right, people who do the wrong thing, they end up getting, God makes sure they get their due. So seemingly that's going to happen to, if it happens to the righteous person who should have gotten off in general, gotten, you know, off scot-free because he has other things to be his merit. So if God punishes even the righteous, of course, God will eventually punish the wicked as well. So Kabbalah Sunrise works quite well, but again, there's a separate issue of how do you deal with Tzadik Baralo, how do you have a righteous person being punished, seemingly unjustly, which is a very long, lengthy philosophical discussion that we, again, don't have time because I see we have 5 minutes left and I want to make sure we get the vote in. Okay? So again, so we still have two more left. So the next one we have is from Megillat Esther. Hopefully this one, so this is, I suppose before we talked about how Jews can't fight and how they're quite weak. Don't worry, not always. Depends whether or not God is with us or not, whether or not our military might is great or really quite sad. So here we have, I know, you know, it's Hanukkah, but, you know, Purim and Hanukkah is, you know, the same holiday, more or less, not really, but they're related. They're the two rabbinic holidays we have. So here we go. The king said to Queen Esther, in the fortress Shushan alone, the Jews have killed a total of 500 men, as well as the 10 sons of Haman. What then must they have done in the province of the realm? What is your wish now? It shall be granted to you. And what else is your request? It shall be fulfilled. So, right, so Ahasuerus sees the great success of the Jews in Shushan and how many people they managed to fight back against and beat. So, if they manage to do this well in the capital, which is the most difficult place to fight, then he says, even more so, Kabbalah Chomer, they must have done an amazing job fighting against my enemies and their enemies throughout the rest of his kingdom. Which is true, right? The Jews killed thousands of their enemies all throughout the kingdom, which is why we ended up establishing Purim, not just in Shushan, but actually for all the Jews. And last but not least, we have one from Yechezkel, which is stating, which is again just referencing the stating how again preparing the Jews to a grapevine, right? How basically they keep getting worse and worse. Even when it, I mean, the grapevine was whole, it could not be used for anything. How much less when fire is consumed and it is charred? Can it still be used for anything? So for the Bereshit Rabbah, it's a little bit different. It says that if the wood of a grapevine has little use when it is whole, it obviously has no value when it is charred. So basically, right? So again, if it was barely usable before when you burned it, then it's definitely not going to be better than before. It'll be worse. Okay. Right? So those we have are 10 kalach. So that is our 10th and final kalachomer. Okay? So let's... So I'll run this again very quickly. And then I will ask to get ready for a vote. Okay? So remember, again, so we're going to go 1 through 10. So again, everybody can get a single vote. We can see which one wins. Okay? The first case is the brothers saying how we return the silver. How could we possibly steal it from you? Case number two, Moshe, the Jews don't listen to me. How could Paro? Case number three, if your father is spat in your face, you go hide for a week. Even more so, if God spits in your face, you'll have to hide for at least a week. Next, we have Moshe doubting the Jews will do the right thing. Again, by saying that if you're sitting while I'm alive, that's terrible. Even more than when I'm dead, you're going to be even worse. Then we have Yirmiyahu. The two of them, one is the question, you think you can beat, if you can't win a foot race, how do you expect to get on a horse? And we have, if you can barely even make it in safe Israel, you think you can make it in the wild, wild Jordan, not a chance. Okay, then we have, right, so that's 5 and 6. 7 is David's men being scared. We're scared of Shaul. Of course, we're scared of the Plishtim. Number 8 is reward and punishment. 9 is the military might of the Jews in the Purim story. 10 is use of grapevine wood. So I'm going to stop the share. Okay, so let's have a vote.
Okay. What's the vote based on?
Which one did you like the best on whatever criteria you have, right? Which one did you felt was the best argument, coolest story? You simply like it the best because you don't like when Jews are compared to burnt grapevines, but you like the being the strong and mighty, or you like the whole, like, you know, trying to, whatever reason you have, okay? So I'll go first. So the one that I like the best, in terms of the one that was like least depressing, would be, right? So the one that like I thought was most positive would say is that of from Megillat Esther, where it's showing how the Jews, you know, finally do something right, and you know God is behind them, and they're able to actually conquer not just here. And not just in Shushan, but actually all throughout the empire, which is quite good.
I'll say number 4.
Number 4. Okay, that was. So you're voting for the for Moshe not trusting the Jews to be any better after he's gone. Okay.
I like Moshe's second one. I said number 3.
Right. Let me go back to sharing the screen then. That way everybody can see which one that was. Okay. So number 3 is this one, right? I mean the Miriam one or the one?
No.
This one?
Yeah, that one. Yes.
Yes. So if the Israelites don't listen to me, then how could Paro listen to me? Right. Okay. Good. Right. Okay. Who else hasn't voted yet? We've got. I think we've got Elaine, Alan, and my mom. I haven't voted yet. You don't have to vote. You can abstain. That's allowed also. So
I like the proverb, the one the righteous get their just desserts.
Yep.
Or deserts.
Right, or deserts.
Let's hope they get their desserts. It's Hanukkah. I hope they get some nice juicy donuts. So. Oh,
I'm abstaining.
Okay. You got an abstention? Okay.
Yeah, me. Sorry. Fine.
That's fine. Okay, but hopefully, yeah, so the goal of what we did today was to hopefully get a little taste of the various types of Kal V'Chomers as are seen in the Torah, as in Tanakh, and hopefully we'll, you know, be able to, you know, have a little better understanding when we are, whenever that term comes up in davening. Also, we'll hopefully know more for Midrashim in general of how they at all interweaves.
How, what is the Hebrew terminology for plural Kal V'Chomers?
Yeah.
Kal V'Chomerim?
Kal V'Chomer.
Kalim V'Chomer. Okay.
I mean, it has it in the, the first. Kalim V'Chomerim. There's the Aramaic one.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was in the beginning of I guess it'd be, so that's Aramaic Kalim V'Chomerim. So I guess he would be Kalim V'Chomerim. I just never it doesn't really end up being used that way.
Alan, did you want to vote?
Yeah, Alan, you can still vote. It's not, the voting is not closed.
It's rigged.
It's rigged. It's just...
Okay. Well, okay, so I would like to wish everybody a happy Hanukkah, and I look forward to seeing everybody next week at 8:15. We will be doing a midrash on Vayigash.
Okay. Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah.
Very good.
Happy Hanukkah.
Good night.